Hello and welcome to Paradox Podcast. This is episode 61 and it is titled The Burnt Offering. Now, we're going to be looking at Leviticus 1. But before we get to Leviticus 1, we have to talk about what we talked about last week. Leviticus takes place after Exodus. And Exodus ends by the Israelites being freed from 400 years of Egyptian slavery. Once they are freed, once their oppressor has been crushed, God then asks them to build a temple. But it's not just any temple, it's a portable temple known as a tabernacle. And so the Israelites build a tabernacle to God's exact specifications. And once they do that, God then descends from heaven and inhabits the tabernacle, and then God begins to speak. And when God begins to speak is when Leviticus begins. Now, when God speaks, that raises all sorts of complications because what God says has to stand for all time and have a wisdom beyond its years. But we talked about last week the problems of placing that kind of burden on the words of God because Leviticus is not the original inspiration. Rather, Leviticus is an interpretation of inspiration. And if it sounds like we're glossing over that, I'd encourage you to go back and listen to episode 60 and understand how we got to that conclusion, because otherwise the rest of the Leviticus series won't make sense. So God begins to speak from the tabernacle, and he speaks for a long time, and he speaks for 92% of this book of Leviticus. And when he begins to speak, he starts to talk about five different offerings. And these five different offerings are brought forward in Leviticus 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. So today we're going to talk about Leviticus chapter 1, and the offering that's entailed in there, and it is known as the burnt offering, or the Hebrew word for it is the olah. So let's read Leviticus 1 and read about God telling the Israelites about the olah. Verse 1 says, "The Lord summoned Moses and spoke to him from the tent of meeting, saying, 'Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when any of you bring an offering of livestock to the Lord, you shall bring your offering from the herd or from the flock. If the offering is a burnt offering from the herd, you shall offer a male without blemish. You shall bring it to the entrance of the tent of meeting for acceptance on your behalf before the Lord. You shall lay your hand on the head of the burnt offering, and it shall be acceptable in your behalf as atonement for you. The bull shall be slaughtered before the Lord, and Aaron's sons, the priests, shall offer the blood, dashing the blood against all sides of the altar that is at the entrance of the tent of meeting. The burnt offering shall be flayed and cut up into its parts. The sons of the priest Aaron shall put fire on the altar and arrange wood on the fire. Aaron's sons, the priest, shall arrange the parts with the head and the suet on the wood that is on the fire on the altar. But its entrails and its legs shall be washed with water. Then the priest shall turn the whole into smoke on the altar as a burnt offering, an offering by fire of pleasing odor to the Lord. If your gift for a burnt offering is from the flock, from your sheep or goats, your offering shall be a male without blemish. It shall be slaughtered on the north side of the altar before the Lord, and Aaron's sons the priest shall dash its blood against all sides of the altar. It shall be cut up into its parts with its head and its suet, and the priest shall arrange them on the wood that is on the fire of the altar. But the entrails and the legs shall be washed with water. Then the priest shall offer the whole and turn it into smoke on the altar. It is a burnt offering, an offering by fire of pleasing odor to the Lord. If your offering to the Lord is a burnt offering of birds, you shall choose your offering from turtle doves or pigeons. The priest shall bring it to the altar and wring off its head, and turn it into smoke on the altar, and its blood shall be drained out against the side of the altar. He shall remove its crop from its contents and throw it on the east side of the altar in the place for ashes. He shall tear it open by its wings without severing it. Then the priest shall turn it into smoke on the altar on the wood that is on the fire. It is a burnt offering, an offering by fire of pleasing odor to the Lord." And that is chapter 1, where God describes the olah, the burnt offering. God invites the Israelites to come into the courtyard before the Lord and bring a bull or a male sheep or a goat or a bird, and wring off its head, or slash it with a knife, and kill it, and then wash it, and slice it, and dice it, and blood is flowing everywhere. And at this point, you say, what is up with this God, and why would God command people to do this? Why does God need this burnt offering, And why would people practice this with the understanding that this sacrifice had something to do with God? After all, we are killing innocent animals. And while most people may think to themselves, well, this is a good thing because eventually these animals have to die for food anyways, there's a problem. Because when it comes to the olah, the burnt offering isn't consumed for food. So in the midst of all of this animal death, the question why is really at the heart of Leviticus 1. Why would humans do this? Why would God ask for it? Why are we going through this ceremony where people bring these animals before God, kill them in God's presence, and then light them on fire, and somehow that is pleasing to God? And so if you were to hold up Leviticus to most Christians and say, why is it that God would ask for such a gruesome, vicious, violent death of an animal and require people to carry that out? Most Christians will respond, well, the reason for that is so that they could be forgiven of their sins. And this whole process of bringing an animal to the tabernacle and slaughtering it and then offering it as fire was ultimately a sign that their sin had been forgiven. And because people live in sin, Christians would say, they had to do this on a regular basis. But that's an oversimplification. Because when you hear Jews speak about what the sacrificial system meant, you realize that they have an entirely different understanding of what it means to offer the olah. Specifically, the rabbi Jacob Milgram writes about the sacrificial system in his commentary on Leviticus, and he says, sacrifices cover the gamut of the psychological, emotional, and religious needs of the people. In other words, if someone were to ask a Christian, why do you pray? Very few Christians would say, well, I only pray for the forgiveness of sins. Now, Christians would, of course, say that that's one of the things that prayer does, but prayer for Christians covers the psychological, emotional, and religious needs of the people. In the same way, this whole sacrificial system, and particularly the olah, covers the gamut of those different things. And so while forgiveness of sins is definitely a part of what sacrifices meant to the Israelites, Jacob Milgram says it's much more than that, in the same way that prayer is much more than asking forgiveness of sins. Milgram continues by saying, behind the specific laws of sacrifice is a profound design for creating a sense of spiritual connectedness. In sacrificing, people felt a direct line of communication with God. The sight of smoke ascending heavenward could be seen as a physical symbol of personal prayers and wishes rising to God. By inviting people into the sanctuary for the sacrifice, people felt themselves personally invited into God's earthly home. In essence, the system of sacrifice provided a metaphor, a method for the Israelites to reach God, responding to these deep psychological, emotional, and religious needs of all people. So what Milgram is saying is that people would bring all of these multifaceted and diverse needs to the tabernacle with their sacrifice, and then they would go through this ceremony of slaughtering an animal in complete silence in the presence of God. And when they lit this animal's carcass on fire, there was this sense that God received that sacrifice, that God heard that sacrifice, that God smelled that sacrifice. And that's reiterated three times within the words of God when we read an offering by fire of pleasing odor to the Lord. So Milgram looks at this sacrifice and he says, you want to know the inspiration behind the interpretation of Leviticus 1? He says it's this. There is a desire for the Israelites to be connected with God, because there's this sense that there is a disconnect between them and God. There is a disconnect between them and nature. There's a disconnect between the holy and the human. And this sacrifice reestablished the connection, reestablished a relationship, reestablished God's covenant, and reminded them that they were loved by God. The inspiration behind the olah is very simple. There is a desire to be connected with God. And so you have this strange and bizarre and seemingly inhumane ritual of the olah that the Israelites profess brought them closer to God, reestablished a connection with God. And in our modern mindset, we hear these words and we think to ourselves, you have to be joking me. How on earth did this fire, did this death of an animal bring someone closer to God and provide a connection with God? Well, if you're asking that question, I have to tell you that I've asked that question in my life several times as I've read through this book before. But what's helped me to see this book in a different way is to remind myself how different the people were who wrote these words, and specifically how different things were back when Leviticus was written. If we were to go back to ancient, prehistoric times, we would come across cave people. And cave people were very different than you and me because cave people were a lot more dependent on what they would call God or the gods in order to survive. For instance, cave people would stumble out of their cave and they would look up at this vast expanse of blue known as the sky. And they had this sense that the sky, as distant and as far and as impossible it was to reach, was somehow connected intimately with their survival and sustainment of life. After all, they needed rain to fall to water their crops. They also needed the sun to shine in order to grow their crops. And if there was too much sun or too much rain, then their crops would not grow. And so in the sky, you have these objects which they personified because they seemed to be temperamental. And while these objects were very distant and no one could touch them, there was this sense that there was a connection to the sun, to the moon, to the stars, to the clouds. And yet, despite that connection, there was distance and ultimately a disconnection. This is why our ancestors so long ago believed there was something spiritual in climbing a mountain. It's because it brought this human existence as close as it could be to the sky, which was the great giver and sustainer of life. Now, as you can imagine, as time went by, people began to personify the sky and personify the objects within the sky. And so religions sprung up all around the world, all of them worshiping different things, all with their own systems of giving. And all of these different systems of giving were ultimately to bring the gods of the sky closer to humanity. In other words, it was this desire for connection with God. Now, one of these tribes was a tribe known as the Israelites, and they were originally enslaved within Egypt. Their story goes that they were enslaved for 400 years there until their God miraculously intervened within life and freed them from the Egyptian people. And once they crossed the Red Sea, they were breathing fresh, free air for the first time in 400 years. And it's almost like they looked around at each other and asked the question, so what do we do now? We believe that God has given us this liberation, but does that mean that we stop offering sacrifices to the God that we believe has liberated us? And so on the other side of the Red Sea, there was this sense that God was still up there beyond the sky, and they believed that God was telling them to build a dwelling place among them on the ground. They had this sense that they were disconnected from God and that God was up there and other and could barely hear them. And there was this longing to bring God down to a world where they lived. And so they built a tabernacle. And they tell people that God has spoken from the tabernacle. And the way for God to recognize them, to validate them, this God of the sky and the sun, the moon, the stars, the way that this God hears their prayers, essentially, is through this olah. Now, once again, this all sounds otherworldly. But that's because we have to remember that we have conquered the sky in 2017. We can fly just about anywhere we want in the world in a matter of moments. And all we have to do is drive to an airport and we are in the sky and the ground does not own us in the same way it did so long ago. But you have to remember that this is a relatively new understanding of our humanity. Because in 1903, the very first people flew heavier than air aircrafts. The first two people ever to fly, ever to conquer the ground, were two brothers named Orville and Wilbur. And they conquered flight, conquered gravity at Kitty Hawk, North Carolina in 1903. Now, you have to understand that these people are standing on all of the shoulders of humanity that came before them. And they were able to get their airplane in its first flight off the ground. And it was about, it started at 3 feet and then it got up to about 7 or 8 feet above the ground. Not only that, but it went at approximately 7 miles per hour. And we have to remember, it took 200,000 years of humanity, some people would say, for them to get to this point. And it's just insane to think about that it's that long of time before people could begin to fly. Because as much as that flight seems primitive by our standards today, it was only 65 years later that we were then landing people on the moon and walking around. And so when we look at the sky, we see something very different than what our ancestors and our cave people ancestors looked at. Because they looked at this sky and it was this infinite, inaccessible expanse that ultimately reminded them of their disconnection of the source of life. But we look at the sky and we know what it's like to send a human being beyond its limits. In 1961, the Russians launched a spacecraft known as the Vostok 1, and on it was one human being, and this human being became the first ever human being to be in space. His name was Yuri Gagarin, and he broke through the stratosphere up into space, and he looked out at the vast expanse of space, the very first person ever to see it with a naked eye. And there's a legend that he radioed back down to Mission Control. While he was up there, he said these words. He said, "I see no God up here." What a strange thing for a cosmonaut to say in space. But what he's ultimately doing is he's looking back at all of his ancestors who were told over and over again, who told stories about how God lived beyond the expanse of the sky. And he heard all of it. And he essentially said, "Well, here I am beyond that expanse, and I'm here to tell you that God isn't here." And when you talk to scientists, they start to talk about how much bigger our existence is and how much bigger our universe is than what we knew it to be just a few hundred years ago. In fact, scientists will tell you that the universe is 46 billion light years in diameter. That is unfathomably big. And yet Christians still adhere to this idea that God is bigger than all of that. And while we proclaim a God that is bigger than all of that 46 billion light year in diameter universe, it ultimately speaks to this sense that God is very distant, that God is very far away, and that we are disconnected from the source and the life and the giver of all. There is distance between us and God, and we wonder how to bring God closer. The great Richard Rohr once said, "The greatest disease facing humanity right now is our profound and painful sense of disconnection." We feel disconnected from God, certainly, but also from ourselves, from each other, and from our world. Our sense of this fourfold isolation is plunging our species into increasingly destructive behavior and much mental illness. In other words, Richard Rohr says this sense that there is distance between us and God, us and ourselves, us and the earth, and us and others, is ultimately fostering hatred. And so when we look at the sky and begin to think about the unbelievable expanse of space beyond the sky's limits, we shout to the heavens and say, "Is there anyone out there? Does anyone hear me?" And when we read Leviticus 1, the answer comes back, yes. God, who created all of this, hears you. The inspiration at the heart of Leviticus 1 is simply this: God hears you. God sees you. This being that the tribe of Israel has testified to for thousands of years is ultimately a personal God who cares and hears and considers and has compassion toward you and toward me. And the Israelites developed this offering, this burnt offering, the Olah, as a reminder that God hears me. And the story of Israel is this story about how if you open yourself to this reality, if you actually commit to it, if you believe that there is one God who created all, then you will not feel disconnected from everything around you, but you will feel more and more connected to the earth, to yourself, to others, and to this God. And what the testimony of Leviticus 1 is, while it sounds like an instruction manual, is ultimately a testimony of a God who is as near to you as as spoken word. It's a testimony about a God who has ears to hear your prayers. It's a testimony about a God who has a heart to feel compassion for you. Now, all of this is impossible to prove, but this is what the Israelites would tell us today. That's where faith comes in. And if you trust this story, you will become a more loving, compassionate, concerned, and beautiful person. Because you will not feel isolated or cut off. Instead, you will feel connected. Now, all of a sudden, when you consider those people that seem so different than us, these people that seem so long ago, these cave people that are ancestors, you think back to them and you think to yourself, what do we have in common? And you think about the very things that make up your existence, and you start to feel the beat of your heart. And you are reminded that while your ancestors seem distant, every one of them had a beating heart just like you. And that beating heart was given its beat by God. And all of a sudden, they don't seem that distant to you anymore, do they? They seem like your brothers, your sisters. You think about the breath that you breathe every moment of your existence. And you're reminded that one of the oldest understandings of the intimacy of God is the human breath that fills our lungs and then leaves our lungs. And all of a sudden, your ancestors are connected to you through your breath. Think about how all of us come into this world. It is only a recent phenomenon that we've added machines in this process, but normally there's only one sound in a birth throughout human history that has been consistent. And all of us, every human being has come into this world weeping as we fill our lungs with oxygen for the first time. You think about God that created this soil, this earth that is so miraculous, and the idea that you can grow things with predictability is just a mind-blowing miracle of science. And when you think about rain and how rain falls from the sky, sometimes you forget how valuable rain is until you live in a drought-stricken state like California. And we've been in a drought for like the last, I don't know, it feels like 38 years. But when rain started to fall again this winter, it was so good to take off a rain jacket, to not pull out an umbrella, but to just go out and feel the rain again. There is something about being connected to the soil and to the rain and the sun that reminds us of God's goodness and that we are not alone. And our ancestors, as distant and as far as they may seem, have ultimately looked to the sky for the sustainability of life. Have you gone on a hike up a mountain recently? Because when you hike up a mountain and there's something seemingly spiritual about it, you are reminded that this has been a spiritual practice for thousands and thousands of years. Or have you sat around a campfire with your friends and you've talked and you've laughed and you've told stories, then all of a sudden every one of your friends have fell silent as you listen to the fire cackle and you look up at the stars and they stretch forever. And you think about a God who has created these stars that are so far away and yet are so much a part of human life. And you say to yourself, there has to be something more than this. There is some connection that I am feeling that I haven't felt before. And it is here, as you look up at the stars and you see the smoke rising to the sky from the fire, that you are reminded of an ancient ritual, the Olah, in which smoke would rise to the sky. And you were reminded that the God that created all of this, that God, that being that created everything you experience, both good and bad, that God is personal That God is connected to you. And that God hears you. For hundreds of generations, human beings have sought a connection to something bigger than themselves. It's almost like it is wired into our DNA to look beyond the natural and look for a supernatural connection to ourselves, to the earth, to others, and to ultimately God. May we be reminded of the goodness of the Allah. And if you are feeling alone or if you feel like God is too distant, may you be reminded of the promise of Scripture. And that promise is simply this: God hears you. May you, my brothers and sisters, see and embrace the inspiration in all.